Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
I don't think that Christianity and angst and fear have to be synonymous, but I think a lot of us were raised in a tradition where they were.
I appreciate on some level the deconstruction discussion because it's attempting to be honest and at least acknowledge what is. And I think that is so important.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, hello and welcome along to the show that brings you conversations that matter. Former CCM musician Audrey Assad and Father Chris Foley of the band Luxury joining me, Justin Brierley, today to talk about deconstruction, specifically Audrey's own deconstruction. I'll introduce them shortly. And later on, I'm going to be interviewing a friend of the show, Tim Hull, about his new YouTube channel, Creating a Space, to talk about deconstruction. So look out for that later on in the show. Do you want to be part of the programme? Well, on Tuesday the 7th of December, I'll be hosting Christian thinker and Oxford professor John Lennox for a Q&A on science, faith and God, taking live questions. You can be part of our online audience. It's all brought to you in partnership with Caris Productions and Pensmore Films, producers of the award-winning film Against the Tide on John Lennox's life and ministry. If you want to be part of Unbelievable Live with John Lennox, just register, absolutely free to do so, at unbelievable.live. You can find a link with today's show. Really looking forward to that live edition of the show with listeners joining us from all over the world. And by the way, happy Thanksgiving to all US listeners of the show. Hope you had some good conversations around the Thanksgiving table along with your turkey and pumpkin pie. Now, Giving Tuesday has become a new regular tradition on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving weekend, and it's coming up on Tuesday the 30th of November. It's a really great way to support the show. This is a listener supported show, and on Giving Tuesday your gift gets doubled. So if you're giving from the US, all gifts up to $5,000 will be doubled. So if you want to do that, please go to our US giving site. That's at premierinsight.org/givingtuesday. And from the UK or anywhere else in the world, you'll also see your gift doubled up to £10,000 thanks to another generous matching gift. To do that, go to our own show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on give to make your Giving Tuesday gift. So you can actually make your gift right away. You don't have to wait till Giving Tuesday, but that matching gift is only available until midnight on Giving Tuesday, the 30th of November. So you need to do it by the end of Giving Tuesday. Again, thank you for your generosity on Giving Tuesday. We did it sort of for the first time last year, made a huge difference to us as we try to bring you more of these conversations that matter. If you can stand with us, it makes a huge difference. Again, that's premierinsight.org/givingtuesday to give from the US and premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on give for the rest of the world. Links for that are with today's show as well. Okay, time to get into today's discussion. Hope you enjoy this conversation on deconstruction. Today we're talking about deconstructing and reconstructing faith in the Christian music scene with Audrey Assad and Father Chris Foley. Now, there have been a host of stories in the last few years about Christian musicians deconstructing their faith, or even deconverting altogether. The list of so-called ex-evangelicals includes Michael and Lisa Gunger, Dave Bazin of Pedro the Lion, Kevin Max of DC Talk, John Steingard of Hawk Nelson, and others. And today I'm joined by someone with a somewhat similar story, though she'll tell it for herself. Audrey Assad had a critically acclaimed career as a Catholic in the CCM scene ever since her debut album The House You're Building in 2010. However, this year she revealed that she no longer considers herself a practicing Christian, and she's been exploring alternative forms of spirituality. So we're going to hear Audrey's story today. On the other side of today's discussion is Father Chris Foley. Chris is one of the members of the, I don't know, for want of a better word, alt-rock band Luxury, though he can define exactly what their style is. Their recent documentary Parallel Love tells the story of how the Christian faith of the band members was impacted by a road accident while on tour, and why three of the band members, including Chris himself, have gone on to become priests in the Orthodox Church. So interesting stories on both sides today. And we'll be examining the music of both my guests, why their journeys have gone in these different directions, and what we can learn about the process of deconstruction in the Christian music scene. So Audrey and Father Chris, thank you very much for joining me on the show today. Let's talk to you first of all, Audrey. It's lovely to have you on. And tell us a little bit about your journey, both as a Christian, where that started for you, how you got into the Christian music scene, and then you can bring us up to speed with more recent events.
Sure. As I usually do, I find myself wondering where exactly to begin, because the story is so textured. But I was raised in New Jersey. I was grown up in the northeast of the United States, and part of a family of like mixed ethnicity. So my mom is white American. My dad is from Syria, from Damascus, and came here as a refugee in the 70s. And so a multicultural childhood experience. Most of our holidays were, you know, Arabic food. We didn't have like turkey dinners for Thanksgiving most of the time. And then my father was, his whole story is worth an interview on its own, but he came to the States in the 70s as an 18-year-old, and in Syria had been part of a sponsored child program. And because they were very poor, he lived in poverty and homelessness in the Middle East. And that person who was sponsoring him took their family under his wing when they came here, which was very helpful because they didn't know any English really. And he set them up with jobs and introduced them to some people, among whom was a man who took them to this church, which was a Plymouth Brethren church, which is a smaller but global denomination of evangelical origin. But it split off of the Church of Ireland in the 1800s. John Nelson Darby. Some people in your corner of the world might actually be more familiar with the Plymouth Brethren than most Americans are, because it's had a strong foothold in English British
and
society.
And it's generally seen as quite a fundamentalist in a sense, yeah. Sort of particular.
Although I will say in England and Australia, I think it's gone to a more extreme direction than typically is the case here. But there are those tendencies here. And because those... Because it's an anti-hierarchical denomination, they're pretty autonomous from each other, these assemblies, as they're called here. So you could have a very different experience from one to the next, which I'm super aware of, because I have friends that grew up in it that had a very different experience than I did, because the culture of that particular gathering was different, because it doesn't have, there's no bishops and, you know, there's no pope. It's a similar to a Quaker type of spirituality in that way, and in other ways as well. But so that's where I was raised. And so it's a small fundamentalist cult-like upbringing, which I'm now aware, you know, after having done years of work to try to untangle the angst I have felt over religion and spirituality. A lot of it starts with that upbringing. And I remember in particular just being terrified all the time of everything, you know, like of physical affection, let's say. I was so scared of that. I mean, I read my journals. I have all these journals from when I was in middle school and high school, and I would write things about how, you know, holding hands leads to kissing, which leads to you know what, and you can't ever do that, and it's bad. And I definitely internalized things in a certain way, and I'm not going to blame that on the people teaching me. I think it was a mix of what was taught and my particular temperament. And I also now know that I have been managing OCD my whole life, which I didn't know at the time. And so I was sort of diagnosed with this form of OCD called scrupulosity or religious OCD about 5 or 6 years ago. And that really cast a lot of light and illumination on my relationship to faith, because I don't think it's easy for me to operate independently of that tendency. So organized religion for me always carried a challenge around not being able to be terrified of hell and doing the wrong thing, you know, hurting someone, hurting God.
Did your kind of experience of Christianity ever kind of turn into something more grace-filled? I mean, I know you eventually kind of took a journey towards Catholicism. Could you
definitely
talk about
that
and
briefly? I would say currently I still have a relationship to Christianity. I mean, I don't think there's a way for me not to do that, and I don't desire to not have a relationship to it. Actually, when I, and I'll say more about this later, but when I announce that I'm not currently practicing, that is the material truth of it. I don't mean to say that I hate it or that I could never practice it again, mm-hmm. or that I hate Jesus, because I honestly don't think any of those things are necessarily the truth. But I am where I am partially because I need to be here. It's sort of, well, I guess wholly because I feel that I need to be where I am.
And tell us a little bit about the music as well, and where, you know, you really started that, you know, your career as a musician in the Christian sort of music world began, which kind of, as far as I'm aware, it sort of ties in with the point at which you embraced Catholicism
to
some extent.
So I was 19 when I started writing music, and I had been raised in a church where, you know, that wasn't really something I thought about doing because of the rules around my gender and those rules being, you know, a woman singing in front of the church is a version of preaching, which would be usurping male authority. And so I imagined a life for myself similar to the life my mom had and most of the women in my circles, which was getting married around 18 or 19 years old and having children and staying home. And nothing wrong with that. It's a beautiful life. And I wasn't really dreaming of other things necessarily until I had this kind of road to Damascus moment at 19, where and that's a whole story unto itself, but my takeaway from that moment was that how I am wired is a good thing, and I have gifts to offer, and they're a good thing for the world if I put them out there. And so when I began to write songs, I was writing all kinds of songs. It was kind of like Christian songs and love songs, and I was singing at like hiring out for funeral singing, which is a whole interesting place to be, and weddings and Christmas parties and bars, and I just tried everything. I was out there trying to figure out what felt good to me, and I'd written a bunch of songs that I ended up sending to a friend who was a producer in Nashville, and there was a string of events that led to that. But basically, I moved up here when I was 24, and I raised some money before Kickstarter. We just put guitar cases out on the end of the stage and raised cash. Like, that was what I did to raise money to record this album, which eventually got me a record deal here in town with Sparrow Records, which is part of Capitol Music Group now, EMI back then. And it was honestly just, I fell into Christian music in a way just because that was the door that opened up to me. Those were the connections I had, and so I started out, I was already Catholic by that time. I became a Catholic in 2007. So I was 23 or 24 when that happened. And then right about that time, a year later, I moved up here, signed a Christian record deal. At the time, there were not a lot of Catholics in the music scene. Matt Maher was the only other one that I knew then. And still one of the only ones that I know that has reached his level of success, you know, as a Catholic, because it is still a strange relationship that Catholicism and evangelicalism have with each other.
Yes.
And so that was how I entered into the scene.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's a big back catalog that we could choose from, but why don't we hear something that's very recent, which is a cover of the Sade song, Pearls, Let's just hear a snippet of this latest release from you, Audrey, and then we'll pick up the conversation again.
This is how she's dying, dying to survive. I don't know what she's made of, but I would like to be that brave. She cries to the heaven above. Oh, there is a storm.
So that's the latest release from Audrey. I'll make sure there's a link to Audrey's website where you can get hold of the song from today's show. In a way, you know, a song like that, and a lot of Sade's songs actually in general, have obviously spiritual themes. And I'm sure the spiritual dimension of your singing and songwriting hasn't gone away, even in this, obviously, just because of this present. But what inspired particularly that tweet that got a lot of attention earlier in the year when you said, I no longer consider myself a practicing Christian? What had been the journey up to that point?
Well, so in 2016, I was diagnosed with PTSD because I was having anxiety and panic attacks with unknown origin. Well, the anxiety attacks had an origin. Panic attacks don't usually. It's sort of like you don't know what the trigger is for those. I had several different battles on that front. And I was going to trauma therapy with a Christian therapist, actually, who at the time that I was going to see her, I could not even say the word God without triggering an anxiety attack. It was really, really hard. And so I had to cancel most of the shows I was doing. I couldn't walk into a church building. I could not bear to be in mass. It was really, really sad because I did not desire for that to be my reality whatsoever. It was just sort of happening. And I realized, though, through those things, those notifications that my body was giving me, that I had some trauma to process that was spiritual in nature. Spiritual and religious abuse are very real things. And at that time, I had not really acknowledged or dealt with any of those realities from my upbringing, which both included my internalization of the doctrines is part of that, but also my experiences with human beings who did, in various ways, abuse their relationships to me. I had one kind of long experience of one of the elders in my church being sexually and romantically forward with me for years that resulted in a lot of pain and residual issues around spiritual leadership. And so that was the beginning of the deconstruction, which, again, I really wasn't looking for. It sort of just happened, and I found myself in it. And it was terrifying, partially because of my fears of hell and my fears of God and my fears of doing the wrong thing, and partially because my whole living had been made, you know, in a world where that connection based on shared belief is very strong. People were listening to me partly because they liked my sound, but in large part also because they believed what I did or shared a lot of that, you know, sure, perspective on the world. So that makes a lot of sense. And I just was like, I feel so responsible for this and I want to be authentic and truthful, but I don't know where this is going to land. Like, I might go through this therapy and then be right back where I was. And so I don't want to say, you know, right now that I'm leaving church because I really didn't know if that would be the case.
Yeah.
I didn't want that to be the case, to be honest. And it's like a lot of, I'm hearing my critics in my head right now going, well, why not just go back if you didn't want to leave? And I wish it was that simple. And it's such a long story. And someday I'll tell it in more detail. But long and short of it is that after a few years of not going to mass because I kept trying to go to mass and having panic attacks, I decided to be truthful about where I am right now. I didn't want people to feel like I was being deceitful by just kind of being quiet about it and not admitting what had gone on and what had shifted. And I did go through an angry phase where I had the burn it all down feeling. But again, I'm not really It's not my style, I think, to come out of the gate with a torch while I'm still processing my own issues. And
what I get from this story is you're as human as anyone else, Audrey, but the unfortunate aspect of it is that often people who are, you know, Christian musicians or musicians in general, you know, with a following, they kind of have to often process, you know, their own journey kind of in public. And that can be a really difficult thing to do when you've got other people's expectations and following and everything else on your shoulders. But we'll come back to your story in just a moment, Audrey. And thank you for sharing so honestly about it today. Father Chris, tell us a little bit about your journey then, because I think it's probably fair to say that the style of music that Luxury embodies is probably quite different to Audrey. But tell us about the band, and yeah, to what extent you thought of yourself at all as a Christian band. I don't know that you necessarily wore that as a label, did you?
No, we didn't. And the fact that there's a lot of discussion about the band now because of our Christian faith is so foreign to kind of our early days, because it's not that we were ashamed of our Christian faith back in the day, but we definitely did not set out to be a Christian band. And in some ways, I feel like when we first started, we were trying to kind of push up against some of those expectations and kind of enjoyed being a little bit, provocative when we would play Christian shows, just to, I don't know, kind of push against that a little bit.
I mean, you never considered yourself part of the so-called CCM, contemporary Christian music scene?
Oh, not at all.
In that sense.
I mean, none of us were really interested in any of that, or we were kind of turned off by some of that, I think, just growing up. But, you know, I grew up in a pretty strong evangelical home. I always kind of differentiate between evangelical and mainline Protestant, because it was very much, we're not Baptist, we're Christian, you know, no creed but Christ. And, so I very much a part of that evangelical experiment, you know, kind of in the 70s and the early 80s, youth group culture, all of that. You know, I'm sure Audrey, you experienced, you know, some of that. Just, a lot of image management going on, a lot of, you know, trying to get the kids all hyped up and excited and, you know, rededicate one's life to Christ 40,000 times. And this time I'm going to mean it, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, just not really a fundamentalist background, just very, like I said, very kind of mainline evangelical. And, you know, so I was, you know, raised with kind of a love for the church, for scripture, for Christ, but I just really felt as I was going into my college years and through high school, I just could not relate. I'd be at these youth group events and I'm looking around and everybody's having this ecstatic experience. And I'm just like, is there something wrong with me? I mean, I feel like I'm just being manipulated here. And, you know, I want something, you know, more, you know, sincere and authentic. And and then kind of through high school, kind of a whole nother story there, I got very involved in kind of the underground, you know, punk rock subculture in the Atlanta area. And, you know, for me growing up as a Christian, I found that these were my people more than, you know, the church going people, because I felt like, you know, here's this underground scene, people really wanted to and make a change, and they were authentic. So I was really drawn to that subculture. And then, you know, going off to college, I went to a Protestant Bible college, evangelical college in Northeast Georgia, to study missions. Not really sure what I was going to do with it, but it was going to be something non-traditional, like going to Amsterdam with YWAM, working with street punks and drug dealers or something, you know, something of that nature. But was in bands all through high school. When I got to college, that's when I met the guys that eventually became part of Luxury. And being in a, it was kind of a culture shock going to this Bible college, because it was a little more fundamentalist. And so I think Luxury was birthed out of you know, the experience of the pressure cooker of that world and expectation.
Let's because in a way that the music itself is, you know, to some extent, you know, quite countercultural. You know, alt rock is the way I described it earlier. I don't know if that's a fair label to put on it. But why don't we hear a little bit? And well, this is the title song of the video documentary that got released recently, Parallel Love. Well, as you can tell from that, it's quite a heavy sound very often that you guys have. I mean, does Luxury still kind of tour together? I know that you've had several albums over the years. Are you guys kind of just getting together occasionally these days to do projects?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in a sense, we thought we were done probably about 2002, or that's when I went off to seminary. But then we recorded another album while I was in seminary. And then the two other guys went off to seminary a few years later. And then 2014 or so, 2013, Lee, our singer, Father David, contacts all of us and says, I'm writing some new songs. Do you guys want to get together? We're like, yeah. So we got together to write and did a Kickstarter, and a lot of our fans were still around, so that they supported that. And then our dear friend, Matt, who's been a huge fan from the get-go, who's a documentary filmmaker as well, he started bringing a camera to all of these recording sessions. And we're like, Matt, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I just think this is a great story. You know, these three guys becoming priests and, you know, all of that. And we're like, who would be interested in this other than like three other people? But
well, several years down the line, we have the documentary. I will link to it. And we haven't got a lot of time just before we go to a break. But give us a couple of the, I mean, some of the significant things in this documentary included. There was a big kind of road accident that really kind of, I think, forced you to think about what you wanted to do essentially with the band. Describe that briefly, and then in the longer term, how you and two other band members found your way into the Orthodox Church of all things.
Right, yeah, I'll try to do this quickly. Yeah, we are, you know, in about 94, we were signed to Tooth & Nail Records, which is, you know, we never really set out to be a Christian band, but here was this label that was ran by Christian people that seemed to maybe be a similar mindset. So we signed, and we went to Cornerstone Music Festival, which is like one of the only Christian things that we would participate, you know, we would participate in. But it was when we were coming back from that festival that the van that we are traveling in, there were actually two cars, we were traveling with another band, the driver lost control of the van with all the equipment in it, and it just turned around and flipped three times. People were thrown out. It was an awful accident. I was in the car following the van, so I was not in the accident, but I witnessed it. And, you know, three broken necks. Our singer was in ICU for a few days. They weren't sure if he was going to make it. But it was a real turning point for us to just start thinking a little more soberly and less about, you know, we want to make it, you know, as a band. But, I mean, we still loved our music, but just things started to take a much more serious turn. You know, just reflecting on what life is truly about. And so during this time, we were also starting to get interested in learning more about the Eastern Orthodox Church. And that's kind of a long story there too. But there was a group of us in the town that we were in that were part of a church. And we, as a group, about 35 or 40 of us, started studying the history of the church. And the more we read, the more we studied, the more we kept coming back to this Eastern Orthodox theology, practice, worship, and it was just resonating on such a deep level with me, that this is, you know, what I've always believed, but never had the words for it. Mm-hmm. And so kind of went through kind of like what Audrey was saying, some anger during that stage of feeling like, you know, I wasn't told the whole story. And, you know, the Holy Spirit continued to act and breathe within the life of the church for the 1500 years that I was told was outer darkness until Martin Luther. And so just to the mystical tradition of the Eastern Orthodox worship and faith, again, just resonated on such a deep level for us, rather than, you know, the rock and roll worship circus and the, you know, God's doing this new thing, that, you know, to fall back into the arms of the church and be shaped and formed by that rather than making it in our image. So that was going on kind of at that same time.
We'll come back to your story, Father Chris, because so much of this is fascinating on both ends, Audrey and yourself, Chris, in as much as you're, you know, you might expect, you know, young guys interested in rock music to want to kind of go to the latest church with the drums and the, you know, the guitars, but you've gone back to something much more ancient in a way, through the Eastern Orthodox Church. But we'll come to all that as we continue to discuss deconstruction and reconstruction of faith in the Christian music scene. My guests today are Audrey Assad and Father Chris Foley. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's discussion on Unbelievable. We're talking about the Christian music scene and hearing the story of Audrey Assad and Father Chris Foley, both of whom have had careers in quote-unquote Christian music / Christian bands, though, you know, we can debate whether these are just Christians in a band or whatever. But the question that we've been looking at today, Audrey, is, you know, why, to some extent, there have been so many of these stories of late of people deconstructing and so on. Yours is not the only one. I mentioned others such as Michael and Lisa Gunga, John Steingard, Kevin Max, Dave Bazan. You know, maybe there isn't anything specific behind this. Maybe it's just that people go on journeys and we're more aware of, you know, our stars, you know, the people we follow through social media and everything else than perhaps we ever were. But what do you think? There's sort of, do you notice anything in this particular kind of whole area of people going on similar journeys to you in the Christian music scene?
I do. And I mean, I know a lot of those people personally. We've had many conversations about why, and without betraying anyone's confidence, I think it's safe to say a similar sentiment or similar feeling to what Father Chris, you expressed about we weren't told the whole story. There comes a point when you were raised in a very insular way, which a lot of us were, to some degree or another, sort of taught that this is the structure of things, this is the order of things. You know, in my case, even like being taught that evolution was an evil philosophy that sought to undermine the creator of the universe, and me getting to a point where my reason outpaced my need to obey the rules because I started getting too curious. You know, I didn't even know who Martin Luther was. I was so insulated from even that because we were instructed only to read Plymouth Brethren authors. And I remember the moment that it changed, because I was in high school and I was in a church library somewhere and I found a Josephus book, and I had never heard of Josephus, which is, you know, he was a scribe and writer at the time of Christ around that same era, in that same era. And I was reading through this book and thinking like, wait, there's more information. What if this is forbidden? Like, what else is forbidden? You know, this kind of forbidden fruit, fear-based way of living can produce a need to go find out what's been hidden. Because in my opinion, a thinking person, which every person is a thinking person, but a curious, intellectually stimulated, interested person, being shown all of a sudden, like, wait, there's a lot more out here I've never even considered or given the time of day to, and I want to do that. I mean, I think it's natural. You know, I don't think it's an evil thing. I think it makes so much sense that when for most of your life you've been told for fear-based reasons to stay away from so much. And I remember my brother, and this is the last thing I'll say about this, but like my brother went on a journey like mine years before I did. And at the time he was really into like Dawkins and Hitchens, and he was trying to get me to come towards that. And he was sending me things, and, you know, I was reading them and going like, I entertained it, you know, cause how could you not at that point? But I remember him saying this thing that really stuck with me, and he said, you know, they said like it would be backsliding for me to, leave behind some of these ideas, and that my life would be terrible, and that my relationships would suffer. And he said, but for me, it's been the opposite. For me, I'm flourishing more than I ever have because I'm allowing my mind to explore the things that it wants to explore. And I'm not living from angst and fear all the time. And, I don't think that Christianity and angst and fear have to be synonymous, but I think a lot of us were raised in a tradition where they were synonymous. And so the exploration phase feels like necessary. It's like an adolescence in a way that we weren't given the chance to have. And so I'm not saying that's what mine is, but I think there's definitely a part of me that's being a 16-year-old now instead of at 16, because I just wasn't given the opportunity to do that.
Father Chris, any thoughts and I guess appreciation, I suppose, for the kind of journey that Audrey felt she had to go on?
Yeah, no, I totally resonate with everything that she's saying. I mean, so in this sense, I guess I'm an ex-evangelical too, because, you know, I feel like, you know, the God that I grew up fearing was this kind of tyrannical God that was just kind of, you know, shaking his finger and, you know, he had to ultimately kill his son in order to appease his own kind of wrathful, I don't know, and to kind of start to study the history of the church and understand that, you know, there's a lot of different ways of thinking about God, even within Christianity, and that the little bubble that I grew up in, when that's all you know, you think that's all there is. But to be, you know, like 24, 25 and starting to kind of read some of the Greek patristic fathers and how they talked about salvation and God, it was like, for the first time in my life, I felt like, wow, you know, God really loves me. And I don't think I never totally knew that. I was told he did, but there was a whole list of expectations and everything. So again, to kind of fall back into the arms of just something new, you know, new for me, certainly, but to realize this little evangelical culture is a little blip on the screen in the history of Christendom. And then to, you know, all of a sudden start to see that a lot of my evangelicalism was a knee-jerk reaction against Rome and all the baggage that comes with that. And then to learn that Eastern Orthodoxy, it's like the second largest body in Christendom in the world.
Is there an argument then that a lot of these quote unquote ex-evangelicals, people who are deconstructing so on, are more reacting to a particular Christian subculture, and maybe a subculture that they've kind of seen the dirty side of having been in the CCM scene, if you like, rather than Christianity itself necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly my perspective, but, you know, I'm not, you know, I haven't come to the kind of the same place like Audrey has, but, you know, from my experience, I feel like I was on my way out of the church. And if I hadn't experienced the fullness of and the joy of the Orthodox faith, I don't know where I would be, you know, at this point. So I feel like in a way I was on my way towards deconstructing, but my beef was not so much with God himself as it was kind of the Christian culture around me. And so, you know, I was angry for a time. I think it's grief, you know, part one of the stages of grief is anger. And so I went through that, but I also knew, like, I don't want to build my spiritual life on anger and being reactionary, because that's just a shifting sand. So the more I read about kind of Orthodox spirituality and the monastic tradition of, you know, we want to be reactionary in the heart. You know, the problem is not out here. the problem is here, and kind of doing this hard inner work, like Audrey, what you described, of just having to struggle through, you know, those toxic, you know, abusive systems. That's part of what salvation, I think, is ultimately. Yeah.
Go ahead, Audrey. I mean, I was going to say that obviously your journey isn't completely encompassed by those experiences you had in the Brethren Church. Obviously, in a way, you could argue Catholicism, not a million miles from the Orthodox tradition.
No, it's close. It's certainly not exactly evangelical. The same, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, did you still not find the kind of the latitude you felt you needed within that tradition? Did you still have just a lot of questions that ultimately led you to feeling it? You couldn't stay there?
Oh, well, these are the questions I'm always asking myself. I mean, currently the way I feel is that when I became a Catholic at 24, it was for most of the reasons you're describing, Father Chris. I mean, and I did look into Orthodoxy at the time, but what happened to happen was that I was catechized by Catholics because that was who I met. I met Catholics at that time who were very devout and very kind of educated in the tradition, which I had grown up around Christmas and Easter Catholics in New Jersey. I mean, I just didn't really realize there was such an intellectual and also mystical component, because the way I observed it was like, this is a dead shell of a, I just didn't know, you know, until I met some Catholics who were much more deeply invested in their faith. And so that was who really helped catechize me. And I did find so much relief from becoming Catholic. It was massively different than where I was brought up. And however, there's so much clericalism inside Catholicism that after a few years, when the honeymoon period wore off and I started to encounter, you know, the clericalism and the different kind of evangelical as well cultural things that have crept into Catholicism, because that's what happens. Things evolve and they entangle with the culture. It's kind of the nature of things. I started to realize that I was starting to come to a place where I was like, wow, my objections to Christianity or my difficulties with it, let's say more so, aren't limited to just evangelicalism. I struggle still a lot with the kind of gender-based ideas that institutional Christianity mainly espouses. And the sexuality discussion is so interesting and difficult, right? Like, LGBTQ issues and LGBTQ people, and how that interfaces with what God wants for love and for sexuality. And basically, I came to a place where I was like, I no longer currently believe in a God who is a singular person with a singular will and mind. And that is the reason I do not practice Christianity, is that at this moment, it does not square with my own intellectual understanding of the psyche to imagine that there's a God who has a kind of list of behavioral desires for people around things like sexuality that we've evolved to have. And again, I'm open-minded. I'm still interested in this, you know. It's not something I've kind of closed the book on and I'm walking away now. It's just, that's where I sit, you know, that's where I am right now. And I am a truth seeker, though. That is my nature. It is how I am. I cannot imagine a life where I'm not always trying to refine my understanding of what is true and good and beautiful, and those transcendental kind of qualities of the God that was described to me in the Catholic Church are still very important. And so, I mean, that's where I am. I don't think it's totally a reaction to evangelicalism. I think I have some, I know that I have some other questions and struggles that aren't limited to just that. But a large part of the reason why I started questioning was that evangelical experience.
Yeah. Well, any comments on some of those sort of particular issues that Audrey ultimately felt she couldn't
stay in the Catholic Church? Thinking a few things. I mean, kind of what drew me to the Eastern Church is that, you know, for us, the model of our understanding of salvation and our relationship to God is not a courtroom, but it's a hospital. And, you know, I think having that mindset, it changes a lot of things, or it certainly did for me, you know, that Christ is our divine physician and healer. And, you know, if we speak of sin or of missing of the mark, it's, you know, we're just ceasing to, you know, kind of live this true, authentic life in Christ. And so salvation is about healing, about change, and about transformation, rather than being kind of declared righteous and, you know, kind of the substitutionary atonement models and things that are in that legal system. And so this certainly resonated, you know, with me, because it has room for doubt. It has room for, you know, we are struggling, you know, through this. Salvation is a process that we go through. And on the Sunday after Easter, we have a Sunday called the Sunday of St. Thomas, Thomas Sunday. And even in the hymns, it says we praise Thomas's doubt. And we sing, "Oh, most wonderful doubt of Thomas, doubt bore certain faith." There is this sense that, you know, it was through even Thomas's doubt, you know, that we have these, you know, scriptural accounts of, you know, Thomas touching Christ's side and all of that. And
I was going to ask Father Chris, I mean, as obviously your perspective on Christianity has changed as you've, you know, gone into the Orthodox Church. A lot of the deconstructing, if you like, Christian artists, and indeed generally artists out there, musicians, I tend to find have a fairly a more kind of diffuse, if you like, idea of God. I think I was reading just an interview the other day actually with Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay, and he actually, his parents, you know, grew up in a church, an evangelical church. Now he says, "Well, now I don't really have a kind of specific idea of God. I think of God more as a kind of shared consciousness." And but very few artists I tend to meet are hard and fast materialist atheists of the Dawkins variety. They I don't think musicians generally like to think that there's nothing but, you know, matter out there, if you like. There's something, but they don't like to necessarily put a specific name on it. I mean, is that your experience, Chris, that of the musicians that you meet, that there is an openness but not necessarily a desire to kind of name exactly what that is?
Yeah, and I think that's why, I mean, I'm a musician, and, you know, that's why it's kind of my tribe a little bit, because what I appreciate about artists, really, of any type, there's the sense of, you know, the journey continues, and let's not put an exclamation point too carefully. There's definitely an openness to the mystery of God and, you know, the mystery of faith. And there's this wonderful quote. Father Alexander Schmemann is a well-known theologian in our tradition. And he quotes this French theologian, Simone Weil, where he says, you know, even though a person might be running in the opposite direction of Christ, if they are running towards what they believe to be true, this truth seeking, they are in fact running straight into the arms of Christ. And I just think that's such a beautiful statement, you know, that the journey continues. And this is why I appreciate on some level the deconstruction discussion, because it's attempting to be honest and at least acknowledge what is. And I think that is so important.
What do you, how would you say your relationship is now to the person of Christ, Audrey? In, you know, you've spoken a little bit about God kind of not being quite such a hard and fast being as such, you know, giving commandments and laws and so on. Where do you put Christ in that?
So several years ago, I got very interested in quantum physics. And of course, I'm a lay person. I'm not a physicist. I don't really have a sophisticated understanding of quantum physics, but it's very interesting to me, so I read a lot about it. Because one of the questions I always lived with as a Christian, as a child, was like, how am I communicating to God? And how am I communicating to Jesus? Like, what does it mean that he's everywhere? What does that mean practically? I don't understand how that's possible. We don't believe in ghosts, you know. We wouldn't call Jesus a ghost. How is it possible for a God and a man to permeate not only space and time, but like all of space and time? The Catholic Church sort of spoke of the crucifixion and the Mass as a moment outside of time that we could return to and enter into at any moment. But again, I found myself wondering, like, what are the quantum physics of that? I don't understand. But interestingly, as I've read about, you know, quantum physics and space-time and string theory and all these different things, it's actually made it sound more possible to me and not less that God could be real, that God could be outside or at least not limited by space-time, linear timelines. I no longer believe in time as linear. You know, it is right here, the way that we experience it. But, you know, however many thousands of miles out, time operates differently. And we don't even know the half of that, right? So my relationship to prayer and to Jesus is still one of curiosity and interest. I don't really find myself praying to Jesus much, but I will always, I think, be curious about Jesus and in a way haunted by Jesus, like as if he were a ghost, because not it's a mosaic of whoever Jesus really is and what I've been taught and what I've experienced in humanity, you know, about who Jesus is. And I'm piecing together a mosaic of him just the way everyone is. And I have no interest in stopping that process. It's not a very specific answer, but I'm forever curious about Jesus and what it means to be in a relationship with a person who died 2,000 years ago, but who has impacted the world as much as he has, with at least his alleged life and teachings, right? I believe he existed, but all of our knowledge is filtered through experience and humanity and being human beings. And I think there's something really profound about it. And also, you know, I don't stress too much about what Jesus is thinking about me anymore, which I hope is good. I think it is. I love what you said about, was it Schmemann quoting Simone Veil?
Schmemann was quoting Simone Veil.
I like Simone Veil as well quite a bit, but I feel that that particular thing you're saying has not changed about me and never will. And that's why I don't lose sleep at night right now. Because I'm like, well, all I know is I'm running toward what I feel is calling me in that kind of deep soul guttural place, and embracing those things. And I will continue to do that, you know? And so Jesus has always been part of that in a way, and I probably always will. Institutional church and Jesus are related, but they're not the same exact thing, you know? And so wherever my journeys take me, I think I'm still curious.
Whereas Father Chris, in a sense, you have found a home in a quote-unquote institutional church. I mean, you are a priest now. So what?
Yep.
How? You know, you obviously have gone on a different kind of journey to Audrey here. What? Why did the pieces fall where they have for you when it comes to, you know, being able to say, no, this is where I place my faith, my trust. This is the institution within which I believe we have been given access to God's graces.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, you know, it's funny because I live here, and so I don't take a step back and think about these questions sometimes. But I would say it has everything to do with the person of Christ and this whole idea of the incarnation. You know, the fact that God Himself, in a mystery and however that works itself out, He took on this flesh. He took on matter. And now matter matters. And now God communicates with us and we participate in Him through material things. And this is the whole underpinning of sacramental life and theology. And that would be the same, I would say, probably between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. But again, with the model being, you know, Christ as the divine physician and healer, it just takes on this other element that, you know, Christ came in order to unite humanity with his divinity, to restore communion, not to just to declare us righteous. You know, a priest friend of mine likes to say that, you know, God came in the person of Christ not to make bad men good, but to make dead men live. And so this experience of Christ as the one who is actively bringing me back to life again to the degree that I want it. Just like Christ, when he healed this lame man by the pool, he asked him a very important question. Do you want to be made well? And so it's just every day I need to wake up and answer that question. Yes, I do want to be made well. Well, that might mean picking up my mat and walking. Christ might be asking me to do the impossible thing that I don't think I can do. And so it's this understanding of Christ. We are participating in his life here and now. He came to show us what true humanity really is, and this restoration to communion with God, where I tend to want to, I think all of us, be, C.S. Lewis speaks of the gates of hell being locked from the inside. We can choose to, like, we don't want it. But then Christ bursts into that place in order to bring his light there and change and transformation. So it makes me a better husband, a better father, hopefully a better priest. But as a Christian priest, I mean, this is what my life is about now, is trying to encourage people and inviting them into this relationship with Christ himself.
Do you miss anything of that yourself, Audrey, you know, as someone who has sort of consciously said, no, I can't do that at the moment? Is there nevertheless anything about the Mass, the sacraments that you miss in that way?
At times, yeah. I think I'm trying to parse out what I'm really missing exactly, because a lot of it is my perception of what it did. You know, all of it is, I guess, in a way, my perception of what it was. But that's a thought loop I often get tripped up in, so I'm going to just skip it and say, just simplify and say what I'm missing. But I think, yes, I really loved, and I have to some degree replaced, but not all, because it's hard to have this same kind of feeling around a diffuse set of ideas. I do miss a shared understanding of how the universe works, and of what, like in the Eucharist in particular, the feeling of meeting with God in matter in that specific way. I miss that because for me it felt, it was very potent, for sure, a potent experience. Even when I wasn't feeling emotions because of it, it just felt, it felt good to have a weekly moment where, in the moment of the Mass, where I was sort of there to sort of commune in a more pointed, potent way, with the God I believed in, the God of my understanding, you know, at that time. And there's not really a church for people who aren't, you know, I mean, there's Unitarian Universalist churches, and I've gone to some of those, and I've visited Episcopal churches, and I've tried it, but it's sort of, the more diffuse it gets, the less it feels, to me, compelling to go to church. It's, you know what I'm saying?
I suppose it becomes less concrete the more diffuse.
The incarnational nature of Orthodox and Catholic tradition was really what drew me into it in the first place. So I don't really have a sacrament now in the same way, although I could definitely make an argument for, and this is another podcast, but my relationship to psychedelic plants having definitely taken on some of that same power for me, but way more rare. I don't do that weekly or monthly or anything like that. You know, it's sort of an occasional journey that I take to deal with or heal from some particular thing. But that is the closest thing I can come up with.
Yeah, but that's so interesting to hear that if there was anything you could reach for, it would be that was physical, that gave you some sense of transcendent communion. Mm-hmm. It might
it's
be
a
psychedelic. Mm-hmm. And just interestingly, just a couple of months ago, we did an interesting show on psychedelics that I would encourage anyone watching or listening to go and check out on that. But we're going to go to a final break. Fascinating conversation. It's always in the last 10 minutes it gets the most interesting.
Always,
and we've only got 10 minutes left, but we'll come back in just a moment, and we'll sort of start to wrap things up and get your thoughts as we continue today's discussion. We're talking about deconstruction in the Christian music scene. My guests are Father Chris Foley and Audrey Assad.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome back to the show with me, Justin Brierley. Why not share the word, rate and review us on your podcast provider? Helps other people to discover Unbelievable. Just before we get back into the final part of the conversation between Audrey and Father Chris. Our John Lennox event is coming up soon. Tuesday, the 7th of December, is when we'll be hosting John Lennox for a live Q&A, Unbelievable Live, and you can be part of it by simply registering at unbelievable.live. Be part of the show and get to ask your question of John Lennox. Again, that's unbelievable.live to register. And just a reminder that Giving Tuesday is coming up. That's on Tuesday, the 30th of November. Your gifts get doubled in support of Unbelievable. So if you're able to join us, please do that. You can find links from today's show if you're listening via podcast. premierinsight.org/givingTuesday. If you're giving from the US, that's the best way to give from the USA. Or you can give from anywhere in the world, including the UK, at our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on give there. And your gifts get doubled, up to $5,000 from the US, up to £10,000 from the UK or other parts of the world, if you give by the end of Giving Tuesday on the 30th of November. Links again with today's show. Going to have time to squeeze just a little bit of your feedback towards the end of today's show, but we're also going to be hearing from Tim Hull, who's a friend of the show and has a new YouTube channel called Dealing with Deconstruction. He'll be telling us about that, very relevant to today's conversation. Coming up later on tonight on The Profile, Sheila Ray Gregoire is a popular blogger and award-winning author of 7 books, including The Good Girl's Guide to Great Sex. That was winner of the 2012 Top Literary Prize for Canadian Christian Books. Sounds like an interesting one. That's on The Profile tonight, or on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. And next week on Unbelievable, a really interesting debate for you. Calvinism or Molinism? Which view of God's sovereignty best addresses the problem of evil and suffering? That's going to be our topic, as I'm joined by William Lane Craig and James White. Now, this will be something of a first, because Bill Craig is probably the world's foremost popularizer of Molinism as a way of reconciling God's foreknowledge and human freedom. Whereas Calvinist proponent James White is probably his fiercest critic on this. They've never debated it before, but it's going to happen here on Unbelievable, particularly debating which view best addresses the problem of moral evil. So look out for that next week here on Unbelievable. Right now, time to get back into the final part of today's show. So we've been talking about deconstruction and reconstruction in the Christian music scene. My guests, Audrey Assad and Father Chris Foley. If you want more about the band Luxury and this recent video documentary, which is available now on a number of services, parallel-love.com is the place to go. And I'll make sure there is a link from today's show. I just really enjoyed watching this documentary, Father Chris. It's just such an interesting story that gets told very well by the producer. So well done on getting that out. AudreyAssad.com is the place to go for Audrey's music. You might want to explore her back catalogue, wherever you get your music from anyway. But as we mentioned earlier, the latest release is Pearls. All of this sort of, you know, makes me wonder, Father Chris, whether there is a way back for someone, you know, like Audrey. I don't know what your experience has been of people you've known who've kind of felt that Christianity, or the version of Christianity that they've sort of grown up in, or to some extent grown out of. Have you seen many people kind of make that journey that I think you sort of went on to some extent of reconstructing something, finding that actually there is something solid there ultimately, that maybe they missed out first time round?
Yeah. I guess the first thing is, as a priest, I deal with people pastorally. We practice confession and, I meet with people and, people are on, it's a spectrum. Everybody's at this different place. And so, part of what I do is, to try and encourage people, to come back, encourage people to come and, come back to that chalice, and no one is too far gone for that. And I think the main thing is to not have an agenda for people. There can be this tendency as a pastor to, put people into these boxes and, you need to do this and, then things will finally, but, I think just really meeting people where they're at and listening to their story and, just kind of be present with folks in that, and know that kind of God is bigger than maybe even like the little categories we tend to want to put people in. You know, so for, I think for me, when I think of my journey, because I feel like I was deconstructing, and then before I kind of got to the point of, you know, leaving church altogether, you know, it just, I found the Orthodox Church, and that really, it's a deep well and really answered a lot of questions for me. But I think that's the main thing, is just really to listen, to not have an agenda. Though, just as a little aside, like David Bazan is one of my favorite songwriters, and I'm a huge Pedro the Lion fan, and I've met David a few times. But, you know, I watched his documentary, and the documentary about his story was beautiful and touching and so painful to see that how painful it was for him to get to that point, that it wasn't like he was just reacting against something. But at the end of the movie, I kind of had this sense of, man, the journey's not over. And, you know, to encourage him to continue that journey. But I felt like a lot of the God he was rejecting is a God that I would also reject. So, you know, I kind of wasn't satisfied with his answer.
Well, that's in a sense why I said earlier, in some of the conversations I've had, I had a similar conversation to this with John Steingard, whose story came out a year or two back from Hawk Nelson, a similar kind of deconstruction story. But again, you know, and I think he was happy to say this himself, the story's not over, and it doesn't feel like he's become a thoroughgoing atheist. In fact, as I say, that seems quite rare, actually, among most of the music folks I know, whether they're considered themselves Christian or not. But I suppose the question is, what if there is a reconstruction, does it get back to anything like an Orthodox Christianity, or are people happy to stay kind of where they are? Now, Audrey, I'm asking questions here that you probably don't have answers to right now. But I guess, you know, and again, it's an impossible question to answer, but, you know, could you imagine yourself coming back to something like Orthodox Christian faith? What sort of, what would have to be in place? Are there questions that would have to be answered? Is it just the culture you don't think you could, you know, swim in anymore? What's your feeling on that?
Yeah, it's a complicated one. Because, as I said, it's like when you start thinking about God from a quantum perspective, you go like, well, God doesn't live anywhere. He lives everywhere. She lives everywhere. They live everywhere. Whatever you want to say about it. I don't think I've left anything behind. I'm just expanding to include more things. And currently, to imagine what feels like a return to an institutional practice where there's a certain hierarchy to who has access to the fullness of the truth, let's say. I'm not even making a definitive statement about that right now, but that is a struggle where I feel like I don't know how I would engage with it exactly. I would happily walk into an Orthodox church right now and go to a service, you know, and engage with God in that context. But to sort of espouse a whole tradition of faith would be hard. It would be, I think there would be a lot of things that would have to shift in my own thinking for that to work for me. So I'm sure there is a way back to that. I'm not necessarily aiming my bow and arrow at that at the moment. I'm trying to expand outside of boxes right now. And who knows, though? I have definitely heard stories of people doing exactly what I'm doing and returning to some version of the faith of their origin. So who am I in my ego to say that that can't be me? I can't say that with any certainty at all. I think the journey is not over. I think it never is over. It never is over. I hope it never is. This is the stuff of life, is this exploration and this curiosity and the healing of my relationship to the idea of God, becoming one of curiosity and exploration and wonder versus fear and angst and terror, is a beautiful gift. And I'm like, whatever life holds, if I can preserve this relationship, then I'm open to whatever path holds.
And I think that sense that Audrey can't imagine herself climbing back into a box, as it were, that she feels is now kind of expanded, Father Chris, is one that many people share. What I mean, in a sense, what would your apologetic be at this point for why you don't feel that the church you are now, you know, part of, is necessarily a box that limits in that sense.
Yeah, I guess I maybe challenge the dichotomy a little bit of, you know, it's either this or it's mm-hmm. that, you know, either God is this, you know, fear mongering, or, you know, mm-hmm. it's this open season. I would say in a way, it's kind of maybe a third option is, you know, our true self is our life in Christ, that he is, in a sense, like I am Father Christopher in Christ. And so, you know, to fall back into the arms of the church, not as institution, but in terms of this participation in God himself, physically, spiritually, you know, it's not a, it's like I said earlier, it's a deep well.
Yeah.
And it's a lifetime of change and transformation and becoming, you know, more what I was truly created to be. And so it's more, I guess, just an invitation into, you know, maybe not limiting God. It makes sense that there's a reaction against, you know, kind of where you've come from. I mean, I think that's good. but to, in a sense, not throw the baby out with the bathwater, kind of like, you know, evangelicals did with mm-hmm. Catholicism.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, I sense that you are still very much, you know, kind of open.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, I think that I am. And I actually agree with you. And I feel that I'm sort of, in a way, espousing exactly what you're saying, which is that I don't think that I've left the stream of Christ's presence, because I love Hopkins. I think a lot of religious people love Hopkins poetry. And one of my favorites was always the As Kingfishers Catch Fire, one of his most famous poems. And, you know, also The Hound of Heaven, which both of these poems, which I think is Francis Schaeffer, is that, I forget the name of the author of that one, but this idea that God is not something or someone who can be outrun or escaped, because we bear the very marks of divinity in our own flesh. And however you want to get to that, meaning you can think that's because of the incarnation, or you can think that it predated that, or that it has nothing to do with that. But if that's your feeling, if that's your belief, as it is mine, I don't feel like I have left God by ceasing to practice institutional Christianity at this time. Nor do I hope I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because I know so many people who are thinking, feeling free beings who practice Christianity and have beautiful, mystical, amazing relationships to God through it. So I definitely don't desire to do that, you know.
We're going to leave it there. It's been a lovely time, a really interesting time. Father Chris and Audrey, thank you so much for being with me on the show today. I will again make sure there are links to both of you and where people can listen, watch and find out more. But for now, thank you very much for being with me on the show today.
Thank you both.
Yeah, thank Enjoy. You. Thank you, Justin.
Let us know what you thought of the conversation. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/premierunbelievable, if you want to follow the show and leave a comment there. You can also find me on Twitter @unbelievablejb for my Twitter account, also available over on Instagram and TikTok @justin.brierley. We're going to be launching some new social media platforms for the show soon as well. But look forward to hearing from you. Coming up shortly, Tim Hull will be joining me to talk about dealing with deconstruction. He's got a new YouTube channel on that. Just before we get to that, just time for one email. Eric Strandness gets in touch, a longtime show listener, says on that show, you read that email from a listener concerned that Unbelievable was hosting less discussions between Christians and skeptics and more shows featuring internal Christian debates. Well, I want to say that while I enjoy the clashes between believers and non-believers, I find the internal Christian debates more profitable, actually. Atheist materialists represent a minority of the world, and while they sharpen our understanding of God, they're irrelevant to the bigger problem of a divided Christianity. Personally, I'm inspired by the internal Christian discussions on Unbelievable because they bring together brothers and sisters in Christ who disagree on secondary and tertiary issues and yet still love one another and in the process show Jesus to the world. We circle Jesus with our denominational covered wagons, thinking that we're protecting the Lamb of God, when in reality the Lion of Judah is perfectly capable of defending himself. We have greeters inviting seekers on board, promising them a glimpse of the Jesus within, but then make sure they view him from a distance with dogmatic binoculars. We warn them that stepping off the bandwagon with nothing but a broken and contrite heart is just too messy and may leave emotional stains on the new sanctuary carpet. Thirsty, they want to run to the fountain of living water, but are instead handed bottles of doctrinally filtered Perrier. Are we Christians such great guardians of the deposit of faith that we prevent others from taking out a Jesus withdrawal? I've also noticed that you sometimes apologise for not having more fireworks between opposite sides of an issue, but I'd say that while dramatic, those shows often generate more heat than light, and the best shows of all are those where guests disagree but also graciously recognise areas of agreement. I addressed this issue in one of my recently submitted blogs, yet to be published, Straw Men Are a Fire Hazard. I think people are hungry to hear civil dialogue, and your most recent shows help feed that need. Thank you very much, Eric, for getting in touch. Eric, by the way, regularly contributes to the Unbelievable blog, which you can also find a link to from today's show if you want to see more of Eric's writing. But thank you for getting in touch, Eric, and sharing your thoughts on that. Well, it's great to be joined on the show now by a longtime friend of the program, Tim Hull, and he's got a new YouTube channel that's doing great stuff on dealing with deconstruction. And recently on the show, I was contacted by a listener called Toby telling their story of deconstruction and how Unbelievable had been helpful in some ways in helping them to come to terms with the questions they were asking. And that's very much, I think, the idea of the channel that Tim has begun. Tim, welcome to the show.
Justin, thank you so much for having me.
It's been too long. Can you remind me, like, when did you first bump into Unbelievable and when did we first start kind of getting to know each other?
Yeah, it was around 2010, actually. So my deconstruction process that I went through was around that same time frame. And I also stumbled onto the Unbelievable show and you were having lots of conversations that I was having in my head and started listening. And you and I started interacting via, you know, messenger and email and whatnot. And then I actually had a show a long, long, long time ago that you were gracious enough to come on. And so, yeah, you and I have been connecting a long time.
Mm. So like so many people, I think your own journey yourself kind of took you to the point of having to put the pieces back together. Now, you're one of those people who have reconstructed, but we're hearing so many stories, aren't we, in the last few years of well-known personalities, both in the Christian music scene, Christian leaders. I'm thinking of, you can reel them off, I'm sure, but right. People who are saying, using this buzzword deconstruction. Okay, what are you seeing? Why recently have we sort of heard so much about this and well-known names who seem to be having doubts or losing their faith altogether?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that are contributing to that. I think number one, more people are starting to just understand that there's more things out there, right? They're kind of saying, maybe the orthodox beliefs that they grew up with, the things that they thought were essential, people are starting to question some of those things. And now there's more of an avenue that's like, oh, it's acceptable to question my faith. It's acceptable to not be a Christian. And so I think that's kind of opening up some of the door with that. I also think the other thing that is significant, and this was played an integral part of my story, is the rise of church abuse, the, you know, the Church Too movement or the Me Too movement that kind of came out of that. Some of that sexual abuse, some of the emotional abuse with the stories of like Ravi Zacharias that are kind of coming to light. The Kristen Dumez book that has highlighted some of those, you know, big issues within the evangelical church. People are starting to say, "Hey, wait a second, I'm rethinking this whole entire thing," and we're seeing that kind of play out in real time right now.
Tell us a little of your own story and how you started to put things together again, Tim.
Yeah, so for me, one of the things that kind of kicked my story off is I had been in Christian ministry just from almost the moment that I graduated high school. So I was, I would say that I was saved at 12 and, you know, really kind of, it just catapulted my faith throughout high school, really dove in deep to my relationship with Jesus, and then went into full-time ministry pretty much right after high school. And then there was a series of, unfortunate events, if you will, where I felt like that I was unjustly treated by the church. I was, you know, being let go from ministries kind of unjustly, was kind of turned down for several positions unjustly, was kind of at the churches that I did work at. There was some, emotional abuse that was going on at some of the different, churches. And so in 2009, I was laid off from a church. There was a big economic downturn here in the States. And we were told by the church leadership in January of 2009 that they were not going to be letting anybody go, that they were going to do whatever they could to keep everybody on staff. Well, 5 months later, that turned out not to be true. They laid five of us off, and I was one of those people that was laid off. And that was a big blow for me. I mean, you know, again, when you leave a church as an employee, you don't just leave your employment, you leave some of your family and friends kind of behind. And so there was, that was really difficult. So that started this process for me, looking at my life, being like, wow, I thought Jesus was this really accepting character. I thought he loved people. And that's not been my experience for the last 10 years. My experience has been rejection, has been abuse, has been shame. And so when I was let go, that really kind of started this, like, man, does Jesus see me the same way that all these church leaders see me? And it was very difficult. And so I had to answer, you know, kind of three main questions. What is the nature of truth? Does God exist? And did God raise Jesus from the dead? And I felt like if I could answer those three questions, that the abuse and turmoil that I'd experienced in the church, I could look at that in a different and a new way and say, okay, this is part of the human sinfulness, not necessarily impacting the story of Jesus Christ.
And to what extent in the other people's stories of deconstruction do you find that it's primarily an emotional response, perhaps, to, you know, issues of, you know, church rejection, being let down, disappointment, maybe even a reaction to a particular kind of Christian culture? And how much is it specifically intellectual issues that are causing these stumbling blocks to people?
Yeah, I think one tends to lead to another. So a past guest that you've had on your show, Joel Freuches, who I've had on my show as well, he kind of catalogs the setting conditions that people tend to find themselves in. And he breaks those down into five different ones. For more information about that, you can check out the show on my channel, Dealing with Deconstruction, my interview with him. But I think what happens is there's these stressors and these trigger events. And oftentimes this abuse, or even the realization of abuse, or when you get on the other side of abuse, like you tend to leave a community where you're being abused, because when we're in it, sometimes we don't always see it. And then when we reflect back on that, that can be a stressor or a trigger event, as Joel calls them. And our theology tends to not always be able to accommodate some of those things. And that's where the intellectual side of it might come in. So typically, not always, but typically, it'll start with these, you know, kind of emotional questions that are driving us. And then we'll start to look for some of those answers about how we reconcile what was going on in our past and those setting conditions, and then what was going on presently, and whether or not our theology can handle some of those things. And I think for me, what I've noticed is that the umbrella of what we call Christianity is a little bit bigger than I originally thought that it was. And I think that's really interesting, is when you start to look at some of these things and say, like, okay, inerrancy, right? Like, you can't be a Christian if you don't hold to this certain strain of inerrancy. But when you realize that, number one, there's more strains to inerrancy than the one that I realized, and number two, that you can be a Christian and love Jesus and affirm that he rose from the grave without affirming inerrancy, right? That's freeing for someone that is looking at inerrancy as like, oh my gosh, I found, you know, I stumbled across Bart Ehrman or something like that, and found out that there was these differences in the original, you know, autographs of the text. And so, oh no, what's going to happen now? And that I think is helpful to process through. So I think it starts emotional and then oftentimes moves to an intellectual thing.
I think the problem is on that front is that the environment in which you're doing that questioning can then have an impact as to whether that's a helpful or a hindrance. So if you're in an environment where there's a kind of an openness to maybe, okay, let's look at alternative versions, if you like, of Christianity or different ways of understanding scripture. And there's a kind of a recognition that, hey, actually there are issues we can happily disagree on, if as long as we're kind of agreed on some of these core issues. But of course there are parts of the church where there's a very almost dogmatic, no, if you differ from our particular interpretation of these chapters of Genesis, or our particular interpretation of the scripture, or our, you know, whatever, then people who are starting to have to question and you know, unpick things, it can be difficult if they're in a church environment which doesn't really allow any kind of you know, theology that may differ from their own.
And I think one of the things that I'm trying to do with the Dealing with Deconstruction community. And it really is a community. There's a Facebook group that goes with it. You know, there's lots of chats that are going on underneath the videos, is to try to provide that space for people while they're going through that process. I would say for me, the people that I'm really trying to catch are these people that are kind of going, like they grew up Christian perhaps, or they, at one point they believed, and now they're kind of starting to have some of these questions. They're saying, man, I'm not really sure I can hold on to some of this. And that's where the community, oftentimes what we find is that people kind of go through this private deconstruction process. They're not really in a community. They're not really asking questions. They're not engaging with one another and having these deep conversations. It's just, oh, I started a question privately. And then all of a sudden, the next time they really mention it, they're done. They're out. They've walked away. And so I really want to try to catch those people that are going through that process, because that's what changed it for me. I had a good friend, Andy Kerr, who is a, you know, amazing pastor friend of mine. He was my leadership coach for a while. And we spent literally weeks going through some of these really deep questions, where I would go to him and say, hey, how do I deal with this? Or what's going on here? And he worked at the same church that I did. So he understood the context in which we kind of came out of that. But he was really to help me answer questions, and he pointing me with certain resources. On the Unbelievable Show was one of those, as I mentioned before, and then just several other books and other podcasts that he introduced me to. And we processed through that whole thing together. And that was really important. So when I was like, man, I really feel like this is growing in popularity, I want to provide a space for those that are going through this. Cause that's really, I think, key, is to say, hey, I'm having this question. Can somebody talk to me about it? Can we just discuss it? And that's what the Dealing with Deconstruction community is really all about.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing it. And so when people go and check out the YouTube channel Dealing with Deconstruction, what kind of videos are you putting out there? Are you engaging directly in conversations? Are you kind of responding to other people's videos? What sort of content are you putting out?
Yeah, it's a combination of both of those. Like, I'll respond to, I think, on some of the more liberal end of Christianity and say, hey, I think we're kind of getting some things wrong here. And I'll play a video from, you know, God is Gray or somebody else that's kind of in that frame. I'll also interview other friends of mine. Elisa Childers and I had a great conversation about purity culture. That was one thing that, you know, because she was one of the people in a Zoe girl in a band. So we talked about that from her perspective, and how, you know, her being part of these kind of purity conferences really affected her in that sense. So I had a great conversation with her. I had a great conversation with Mike Lacona just about his doubt. A great conversation with my friend, our friend, my boss, Bobby Conway, about his, you know, dealings with doubt on our channel. And then I also just kind of hit some topics that I think are important to people that are in this process. You know, I had a video about one of the guys from DC Talk that is deconstructing and kind of left evangelicalism, left Christianity. And so I had a video where I just kind of read through an article and gave some of my thoughts. And then there's other things like Sean McDowell had a conversation with a well-known progressive pastor, Colby Martin. And so I just responded to some of the things that Colby Martin had said. I had a great 2-hour conversation with John Steingard, who you've had on the show a couple times and mentioned a few weeks ago in one of your episodes. So he and I had a dialogue. I responded to something that he said to Jonathan McClatchy. And then I responded to that video, and then Jonathan McClatchy connected us, and he was gracious enough to come on my show, and we did a 2-hour live event and just had a conversation about where he was at and his story. So yeah, those are some of the things that you'll kind of find on my channel, trying to hit some of those major topics.
Yeah. And as you say, you're trying to create a kind of an open space for having these conversations with these specifically people who are going through this kind of a journey. Whereas, I mean, here on Unbelievable, you know, we do all kinds of different people from all kinds, but this is your specific thing is the folk on this so-called, you know, deconstruction path. So thank you for doing it. I think it's a really valuable, I've really enjoyed watching some of the videos. And I'm sure, you know, there are people, as I mentioned, Toby earlier, who's a listener, and many more I know who listen to Unbelievable, who may find this really helpful to go and check it out, as well as obviously Christians who want to be able to engage well with friends and family who are going through a similar process. I mean, on average, do you find that, you know, once people deconstruct, it is pretty hard on average for them to put it back together? Are there stories that give you hope that actually people can find a way through and all is not lost necessarily if you go down this path?
I definitely think that, I mean, I've experienced people, and a lot of the Christians that are on or that are in the group have gone through that process. And so they know and they understand kind of where people are coming from. And that's really helpful. I do see that, you know, one of the things is the political climate here in America, which kind of seems to work against it and could be another contributing factor that I didn't mention earlier to some people kind of scratching their heads and saying, wait a second, hold on. We need to start asking some questions about this thing. And so I find that some of the conversations just revolve around that. Like, why do we hold some of the political views that we have as Christians, and digging down deep into some of that? I remember having a guest on where we talked about the First Amendment and, you know, what that really means. And that was great. His name was Owen Anderson. So yes, to answer your question, I do see people kind of coming back to that. I do see people sometimes holding on to a little bit more of the liberal or progressive Christianity, but then oftentimes they'll start to question some of that and deconstruct that, and then kind of come back more to, you know, traditional or Orthodox Christianity, however you want to refer to it. So yeah, I definitely think there is hope. And I think the key difference is when you find someone that is willing to walk with you and answer those questions. And that's one of the reasons that we do what we do in this community is to walk with people and answer those questions.
Well, I'll make sure there's a link from today's show to the YouTube channel. And from there, can people find links to the Facebook group and that kind of thing if they would like to join it?
Yep. In the description of every one of the videos, the link to the Facebook group is there, so people can check that out and head on over. There's just a couple quick questions to see where you're at, and then you can jump in and start posting. Yeah. It's not a debate group. We're not really debating things. We're more just having friendly dialogue and discussion. And there's several people from the Unbelievable Facebook group that we have that's been around for a long time that have joined that group as well. So yeah, so there's lots of fun conversations in there.
Great. Well, thank you for setting that up and for the Dealing with Deconstruction YouTube channel as well. Tim, thanks for being with me on the show today.
Well, thank you, Justin, for all you do and your friendship. And thank you for having me on to help talk about this issue.
Thanks for being with us on today's show. Just a reminder that that Unbelievable live event with John Lennox coming up on Tuesday, the 7th of December, brought to you in partnership with Karis Productions and Pensmore Films. You'll get the chance to interact with John Lennox if you register at unbelievable.live. Free to attend from anywhere in the world, from the comfort of your own home. Unbelievable.live is the place to go. And don't forget, we would love your support as well for Giving Tuesday coming up this Tuesday, the 30th of November. A regular tradition now after the Thanksgiving weekend, and a great way to support the show. If you're giving from the US, all gifts up to $5,000 will be doubled thanks to a generous matching grant. premierinsight.org/givingtuesday for that one. Or from the UK or anywhere else in the world, you'll also see your gift doubled up to £10,000. So you can go to our webpage for that, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and click on Give to make your gift for Giving Tuesday. Just make sure you do it before the end of Giving Tuesday on the 30th of November for that gift to be doubled. Really thankful for everyone who's able to give and support the show. Those links are with today's show as well if you're listening via podcast. But for now, thanks for being with me. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. Calvinism or Molinism, which view of God's sovereignty best addresses the problem of evil and suffering? I'm going to be joined by William Lane Craig and James White. In a show first, they'll be debating these two different views of divine sovereignty. First time they've come together to debate this, Bill being one of the foremost popularizers of Molinism, and James White, one of his fiercest critics as a Calvinist. Find out what happens on next week's show. I'm excited about it. Hope you can join us too. See you then.